XL pipeline will not adversely affect global climate change. The release of the final environmental impact statement prompted criticism of the pipeline, which will carry tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. A vigil is being held tonight at 6 at the Green Wyatt Federal Building downtown next to the Justice Center. Protesters are publicizing their actions online using the hashtag NOKXL, and that's NOKXL.
In 2002, the U.S. Department of Justice found the Portland police used excessive force against people with perceived mental illness. Since then, the city, the police, the feds, and the Albina Ministerial Alliance have been working out a settlement agreement covering reforms to police policies, training, and oversight. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Becky Strauss of the ACLU.
One of the last sticking points in the federally mandated reform of the Portland Police Department is that the city will hire their own compliance officer. Is this a step forward or just another rubber stamp in a system of abuse? Here is Oregon ACLU Legislative Director Becky Strauss.
The City Council, along with activists in the Portland police reform community, called for the Department of Justice to come to Portland several years ago, and the Department of Justice agreed to do that. They conducted a very long investigation, interviewed community members, bureau members, and the like, and came to the conclusion that the Portland Police Bureau is engaged in a pattern and practice of excessive force against people in Portland, particularly those with mental illness or experiencing a mental health crisis. And so where we are now is several months, even years later from that finding letter, the city and the police bureau and the Department of Justice and the police union and the AMA coalition of community members have come to the table late in the game to hammer out a settlement agreement and figure out what are the changes that the police bureau is going to need to make in the next 1 to 5 years, really, is the scope of this agreement, to make sure that they can return to constitutional policing practice. What is before the judge in federal court right now, then, is that proposed settlement agreement. And Judge Simon is the judge who's taken this case in federal court, and he has been extremely, almost unprecedentedly open to a process in the courtroom that engages the community. And now he's asked for public testimony in anticipation of the fairness hearing on February 18th. Again, that fairness hearing is the time when the judge will hear input about whether the proposed settlement agreement between the city, the police bureau, and the Department of Justice is fair. Community members, individuals, organizations, whomever, are all invited by the judge to submit their comments regarding the settlement agreement in advance of that hearing.
You mentioned the AMA a couple times. What's their status in this case?
The judge has awarded the AMA coalition what he's calling enhanced amicus status, is really kind of a creative way to give members of the community, in particular the AMA coalition, a seat at the table without being official parties to the lawsuit. And so they were able to be a part of some of the mediation meetings that the city and the police bureau and the police union took part in, and were able to come to an agreement with those other parties that AMA has a unique role, they have an important role, and that they should be consulted throughout the process of police reform.
I believe you're quoted in the Oregonian as saying there's serious shortcomings.
That's right. The ACLU does believe that the settlement agreement has some, as we said, serious shortcomings, in particularly the area of how we hold our officers accountable when there is misconduct is lacking. Even the Department of Justice in their findings described the system that we have now as, quote, self-defeating. And yet the settlement agreement does not propose major changes to that structure. So it's our concern that even if everything in the settlement agreement is implemented adequately and fully, that we won't see the kind of police reform that Portland needs because it's lacking this system of officer oversight. In order to have us support that acceptance, we've asked the judge to take two particular steps. That first step is we've asked him to clarify that the AMA coalition, which is essentially the voice of the community in this lawsuit, that the AMA coalition has the authority to go back to the judge and petition the judge if they see that the city or the police bureau is not complying with the terms of the settlement agreement and implementing them the way that they're mandated to do. The second thing that we've asked the court to do is to provide a little bit more guidance about what it actually means to comply with the settlement agreement. The legal term that's required as laid out in the settlement agreement would be that the parties need to substantially comply with the terms of the settlement agreement. For us, we're asking for the judge to be a little bit more specific. How will we, as members of the community in Portland, know when it is that the Portland Police Bureau has substantially complied? When will we know that we're seeing true change at the Bureau?
As the agreement is currently written, who is in charge of compliance?
Well, ultimately, all of the parties to the agreement are in charge of compliance. The Police Bureau has responsibilities. The city has responsibilities. The Department of Justice plays a bit of an oversight role. Everyone has roles that they need to play in the coming years. And there are two particular oversight functions that will help to make sure that that happens. There is the community liaison position that the city has currently posted a job application request for. That person has the role of really overseeing all of the implementation and making sure that the parties are complying with the agreement.
Doesn't the city hired compliance officer have too much control?
I think there are some concerns that the compliance officer is housed within the city. It's really kind of a city position.
That was Oregon ACLU Legislative Director Becky Strauss. Judge Simon is taking public comments until February 18th. The City of Portland is accepting applications for a compliance specialist until February 24th. And I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Trader Joe's has pulled the plug on a controversial development in Northeast Portland, citing community outcry. Majestic Realty, a California-based developer, previously struck a deal with the Portland Development Commission for a subsidized land purchase. A Trader Joe's would have been built on the site. Northeast Portland community groups, critical of the history of gentrification which has accompanied PDC developments in Northeast, said that the displacement of African Americans, not the grocery store, were what formed their objection to the project. African American community groups had picketed the location previously. The PDC, in a rare move last month, acknowledged their historical part in gentrification and urban renewal projects. The property on Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard in Alberta was valued at $2.9 million last year. The land was sold to Majestic for $500,000.
A group of local businesses and residents that oppose a new Hyatt Hotel at the Oregon Convention Center announced today that they've gathered enough signatures on their petitions to put it on the ballot this November. The proposed Hyatt Hotel would be built on the at the Oregon Convention Center and would receive $60 million in public funding. Supporters of the hotel claim that this funding will eventually be returned to the public in the form of hotel and lodging taxes. Opponents include other hotels in Portland which stand to lose customers if the Convention Center hotel is constructed. They've gathered 11,000 signatures to put the matter to a vote. But the petition has already been rejected by county officials, who say that because this was an administrative decision, it can't be brought to voters. The matter will be decided in a Multnomah County courthouse this Thursday afternoon.
Teachers in Medford, Oregon are preparing to go on strike this Thursday after talks broke down between the teachers' union and the district. KBOO's Jinka Soderberg spoke with Rebecca Konefal, who's with the union representing the teachers.
I understand that the teachers' union walked out of the last round of talks. What led to that decision?
They've been in negotiations now for nearly a year. And if you take a look at the district's proposals, they really haven't changed significantly since last July. So when the teachers scheduled the last negotiation session, it was with the understanding that the district was going to come to the table with a comprehensive counterproposal. And what they received was, again, pretty much the same proposal that they've been seeing since last July.
The strike vote was held last week, is that correct?
Yes.
And now teachers in Medford are ready to go out on strike. What's the scene there this week? Are parents worried about the strike? Is there a lot of support for the teachers?
We have been seeing tremendous outpouring of support for the teachers from our community. For the teachers themselves, it's been a very difficult last few days. They've been in their classrooms, packing up their personal belongings. They've been, trying to talk to the community in their spare time. There's been informational picketing out. They've been reaching out to parents to make sure that the parents understand what issues are on the table right now and can clearly see how the teachers are taking a stand for the schools that Medford students deserve. And, in fact, we're having a parent meeting tomorrow night at 6:30 in the community in order to answer questions from the parent group.
So it seems like a very similar situation to what's happening in Portland. I don't know if you've been following that, but the strike vote has not yet been held, but it may take place this week. I wonder if you see other parallels between what's happening in Medford right now and what's happening in the Portland Public Schools.
Well, from my experience with both areas at this point and in other locals across the state, you know, I think that what's happening is we're seeing an attack on contracts and on the bargaining process, truly. In fact, they had at first engaged in interest-based bargaining with the district here, and then the district pulled out of that collaborative process and came back with a counter with their first initial proposal that slashed 118 different areas of the teaching contract. And I think that that's what we're seeing across the state is that instead of coming to the table and negotiating the crucial matters at hand, that we're seeing school boards taking advantage of the situation of, you know, that the economic crisis that we have been in and we're now starting to slowly come out of. But these school boards are taking advantage of overwhelmed teachers and trying to use that as a reason to get in and launch an assault on their contract and basically shift power away from the professionals and into the hands of the administrators.
Does it seem like the Medford School District and Portland School District are getting advice from the same lawyers in these negotiations?
Well, I don't know if they're the same lawyers, but they're definitely lawyers that have been talking to each other from what we've seen.
What are the next steps for the Medford teachers as they prepare to strike this week?
So the next steps right now would be they're back at the table. The bargaining teams are back at the table tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Teachers will continue teaching tomorrow and Wednesday. And hopefully we'll get a settlement tomorrow, and we won't even need to talk about a strike on Thursday. But the Medford teachers are ready if it comes to that. They're ready to take a stand for their schools and for their students. To them, this is worth it.
Well, thanks so much. I've been speaking with Rebecca Konefall with the Oregon Education Association about the teachers' strike that is about to take place in Medford, Oregon. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
I'm excited, almost to the point of being giddy. It's a relief and just anxious to get it done.
Chattanooga, Tennessee Volkswagen worker Jonathan Walden, reacting to the news that workers in the plant will vote on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union. The vote is scheduled for February 12th through the 14th. VW is neutral in the organizing effort. That's important to Walden, who believes the union will win the NLRB supervised election. He says bringing the UAW into VW's Tennessee plant will be good for workers, the company, and the community, and the workers at the plant can't wait to get it done.
Oh, I'm absolutely confident. I have no doubt. The biggest reason that I want the UAW to come in is so that we, as employees of Volkswagen Chattanooga, can fully participate in the Volkswagen system. It's a system of co-determination where management and labor work together to address issues, come up with new ideas, to innovate, just to help move the company forward.
UAW President Bob King says VW is known globally for its system of cooperation with unions and works councils, and the UAW wants to partner with VW and a works council to set a new standard in the U.S. for innovative labor management relations that benefits all involved. Works councils are used in Germany, but if the workers win and the UAW is authorized to represent them in Chattanooga, this would be the first works council in the U.S. King vowed when elected president of the UAW in 2010 to organize at least one of the foreign-owned auto plants in the South. Anti-union groups are worried that if workers at VW go UAW, other auto plants in the South will follow. Unlike many union organizing drives, this employer is not waging an anti-union campaign. And VW called on all third parties to honor the principle of neutrality. The $8.7 billion cut in food stamps that just passed the U.S. House targets mostly blue states controlled by Democrats. Nearly all of the cuts will come from 16 states that voted for Obama. 28 of the 32 senators are Democrats, so the cuts are targeted overwhelmingly at poor people living in these blue states. Food stamps, known as the SNAP program, were boosted in the wake of the Great Recession of 2008-09. The boost is going away along with more cuts. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, that will leave SNAP benefits for 2013 at less than $1.40 per person per meal. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers has reached a tentative agreement with Alaska Airlines on a new labor contract for 2,500 clerical office and passenger service workers. The agreement includes pay raises and job security provisions. The members will be voting on whether or not to ratify the new contract, and the ratification results are expected in early April.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Oregon State Legislature began a 35-day session today, with legislators gathering in Salem for the opening ceremony this morning. Today's session was mostly ceremonial, but some committee hearings did take place, including one which dealt with the issue of wage inequality in Oregon. Here's a recording of some of the testimony at that hearing.
My name is Sunny Pettit, and I am chair of the Council of Civil Rights.
Sunny will be doing a presentation. My name is Nova Newcomer. I'm a member of the Oregon Council for Civil Rights and also a small business owner.
This is after about 18 months of work. We looked at international, national, and state data and came up with all of these ideas, recommendation, and research. So Oregon has been a leader in the past. In 1955, we passed the Equal Pay Act, and in 1963, the federal government came in and also passed one of these. One of the things that we have found is, though, there are still loopholes that need to be fixed. So nationally, on average, women are earning about 77 cents per dollar for every dollar men earn. And minority women, especially African American and Latinas, are making significantly less. These are the wage gaps that women face over time. One of the things that we think about is how this compounds over a lifetime. Even immediately 1 year after college graduation, women are making 7% less. And we know that's not necessarily because of their education, because of what they're doing. It's just something that is making this occur. And over time, this compounds into retirement insecurity, economic insecurity, community insecurity. One of the things up here, we talk about the motherhood penalty. Obviously, this is something that's important to me. What we found is that women mothers will make 60 cents to every dollar a father makes. This is when we start looking at the differences in between different minority groups. For the median income, Latinas are making about 59 cents. Black women are 68 cents. White women are 80 cents here. Asian women are 87.6 cents. There is a significant piece that has to do with gender. In each of these categories, it is women that are making less money. People will say, well, what about women choosing different jobs? Is it about choice? So we looked at four highest positions in Oregon, and what we found was that in these three areas, women occupy this number. They're still not a majority of workers in this area. In the one area where women do make up the majority, in health diagnosing and treatment practitioners, women are still making only 64 cents to every dollar of their male counterparts. So now we start looking at what are the causes a recent study came out talking about breadwinners. Women breadwinners are now two-thirds of co- or single breadwinners of their family. Obviously, this underscores the issue of why it's important. If you put money in women's pockets, they're going to spend it in their communities. They're going to spend it on their children. And in some reports have actually called that it will cut poverty quite significantly. We believe there's a strong business case for closing the pay gap. From all of our research, it has shown that women are, or any kind of equal pay gap, that people will be spending that money in their community. When you also have great talent recruitment and talent retaining, that's also important because you have great workers who are loyal, who care about your company, who care about the community, and are able to stay there and build stronger networks.
So one thing that I always do, I have two young kids, and so oftentimes my husband and I want to try to get out for an evening just to maintain our sanity. And I have babysitters who come in, and they're mostly girls, and they, 15-year-old girls who are looking to have their first chance at employment. As a society, their work is obviously very valued from, at the family level. But when I asked them what their rate was, they said, oh, just $10 for the night. And I said, okay, well, what does that mean? And, does that mean I can be gone the whole night? Or does that mean that I can, that's a couple of hours? And, they didn't know the answer to that. And so I think that we have some recommendations around negotiation and skills training. But, when those first jobs are already at a 7% decrease, when the 7% wage gap already exists for equal work, anyone who runs a business knows that that salary actually dictates future salary and future earnings. And when you see that start to widen over time, you can see that person's value, the internal value is decreased. And so this is an issue that hits women specifically.
That was a recording at the Legislative Committee on Business and Labor held this afternoon in Salem.
With marijuana legalization in Washington State and Colorado, another state, and other states considering passing similar laws, Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber feels it would be smart if the state legislature would preemptively adopt their own legalization proposal to put before voters. Kitzhaber said, "I want to make sure we have a thoughtful regulatory system. The legislature would be the right place to craft that." Oregon Representative Phil Barnhart agrees. Barnhart, Democrat from Eugene, chairs the Oregon House Revenue Committee. His committee would likely be in charge of figuring out how the state would tax legal pot. He told the Oregonian that either lawmakers write a bill in February, or it is likely that marijuana supporters will have another initiative on the ballot. Barnhart says their job will be writing legislation that will break up criminal gangs, regulate taxes, and keep marijuana out of the hands of children.
One of the bills that will be considered in the session that began today in Salem, Oregon, would require labeling of GMO food in this session. On October 1, 2013, Governor John Kitzhaber called for a plan to help deal with the conflicts between genetically engineered crops and those grown by conventional methods. Kitzhaber asked the Oregon Department of Agriculture to formulate a plan of identifying where GMO and non-GMO crops could be grown. This plan was also intended to identify buffer zones between the two types of crops. Kitzhaber also promised to create a task force and work toward recommending legislation for 2014, but the task force has yet to be formed. A bill passed in the emergency session of the legislature in December prevents municipal and county governments from passing their own bills labeling or banning genetically modified organisms, including seeds.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a live report from Chapman Square as Portland partakes in the international protest against Keystone XL Pipeline. At 6, it's Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight, weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 28. Tuesday, partly sunny, then gradually becoming sunny with a high of 37. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are counts per minute in North Portland, 1 alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:28. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crime spree, and you even get a $8.5 million pay raise. Of course, you and I would never get such outrageous, absurd, kid-glove pampering by legal authorities. But then, we're not the capo of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's biggest bank and a crime syndicate that apparently is too big to jail. Jamie Dimon is the slick CEO who has fostered a culture of thievery during his years as a top executive at J.P. Morgan, leading to that shameful litany of crime. Yet, federal prosecutors have bowed to the politically connected Wall Streeter, refusing to ruffle his feathers with even a single criminal charge. Meanwhile, one of the scams that Dimon directly supervised produced a $6 billion loss for shareholders in 2012. And his reign of mismanagement and illegalities cost the bank's shareholders another $20 billion in federal fines last year, resulting in a 16% drop in profits. You might think the bank's board of directors would at least slap Jamie's wrist for the loss of those billions, but no. In January, they rewarded him, raising his pay by some 70% to a sweet $20 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York Times noted that to ordinary Americans, such a reward for a poor performance, quote, may seem curious. Curious? Uh-uh. Try incomprehensible, insane, and immoral. Wall Street's haughty elites continue to demonstrate that they're common mobsters, only not so ethical.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
In November, Oregon voters will have two LGBT issues on the ballot. One of the initiatives would establish marriage equality in Oregon. Supporters claim to already have more than enough signatures to be up for a vote. The second initiative would allow private businesses that provide wedding services to the public to be able to refuse to serve a same-sex wedding based on the business owner's religious beliefs. This proposal would override portions of Oregon's existing non-discrimination law, which currently prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Recently, a Gresham bakery refused to make a cake for a lesbian couple's wedding, although they gladly accepted orders for cakes celebrating divorce, pagan ceremonies, and cloning. A representative of Friends of Religious Freedom recently stated that regardless of how marriage is defined in Oregon, business owners who hold religious beliefs that oppose gay marriage are not going to be discriminated against or silenced for refusing to serve same-sex weddings. Currently, the Anti-Gay Oregon Initiative has not qualified to be on the ballot. Just last month, a bill allowing religious discrimination died in a South Dakota Senate committee after lawmakers admitted that clergy were already exempt from being forced to bless a ceremony that contradicts their personal beliefs. Companion legislation that would have allowed private business to discriminate is expected to be withdrawn as well. The American Civil Liberties Union expects religious groups to continue to battle for discriminatory exemptions as the LGBT rights movement grows.
Watchdog group Public Citizens' name appears among the list of plaintiffs in a suit filed with the district court in D.C. on Friday against the Federal Elections Commission. The lawsuit comes after a six-member panel voted to investigate Karl Rove's American Crossroads ended in a tie last year. Craig Holman is a legislative expert on campaign finance reform from Public Citizen, and he spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan.
In 2010, you asked the Federal Elections Commission to take a look at the designated status of Karl Rove's organization, Crossroads?
That is absolutely correct. As everyone here realizes, Karl Rove set up First American Crossroads as a super PAC in 2010, and when that wasn't pulling in enough money as he expected, especially from corporate sources, he set up a 501c4, Crossroads GPS, to work hand-in-hand with American Crossroads. Now, American Crossroads has as its declared purpose the election and defeat of candidates for federal and state offices, and Crossroads GPS fairly clearly has just become a subsidiary to raise corporate funds to pay for that entire project. And so I filed a complaint on behalf of Public Citizen with the Federal Election Commission saying, take a close look at Crossroads GPS because every piece of evidence strongly suggests that Crossroads GPS is in fact nothing but a political committee whose major purpose is the election and defeat of candidates for federal office, and therefore it should register with the FEC in the same way American Crossroads has and disclose the sources of their funds. And my complaint was not dismissed, but the Federal Election Commission, a six-member commission with three Democrats and three Republicans, deadlocked on the issue as to whether to pursue any further investigation. And once they deadlock, it just renders the whole complaint moot. And that would have been the end of it, except Public Citizen and I have filed a court case against the Federal Election Commission, essentially for shirking its responsibilities and not enforcing the campaign finance law. We will see how this lawsuit plays out in the courts.
Can you talk about what relief your organization seeks?
We are pressing the courts to instruct the Federal Election Commission to enforce the law. The law is very clear on who has to register as a political committee. There are two major components to it. One, does the group raise or spend more than $1,000? And the second is, does the group have as its major purpose electioneering for or against candidates, especially federal candidates? The evidence strongly suggests that is the case. My complaint had been pending before the FEC for 2 years. In the course of the investigation of this, the general counsel for the Federal Election Commission concluded that Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS spent $20.8 million on electioneering activity in the 2010 elections, and that accounted for 53% of the group's entire expenditures. That is major purpose.
Am I to understand that these three members of the Federal Elections Commission went against the advice of their own legal counsel in order to adopt this stationary position of no movement forward?
The Republican members of the Federal Election Commission went against their own general counsel, and they also violated the agency's own established policy for determining who qualifies as a political committee.
What's the next step in this process?
Well, we've got many. Quite frankly, this is just one of the things Public Citizen is pursuing to try to open up the books on dark money. I do want to reiterate that in addition to trying to get the Federal Election Commission to do its job, perhaps the most significant thing we can achieve is an actual constitutional amendment to clarify to the Supreme Court what the First Amendment really means.
I've been talking with Craig Holman from Public Citizen. He is their legislative expert on campaign finance, and you can get more information at publiccitizen.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
British Prime Minister David Cameron says he failed to make a case in favor of the mass surveillance of communication data revealed by NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Cameron said, although communication laws need an update, civil liberties must be kept, quote, in proportion. Cameron told Britain's Select Committee on National Security Strategy that the Cabinet was about to start a discussion of their overseas aid program, suggesting a portion of its budget could be redirected to conflict prevention, adding that he was very worried at the possible danger posed by British citizens coming back, quote, radicalized. Cameron claimed that Snowden's exposure of the mass surveillance has damaged UK national security interests, saying, newspapers that covered the leaks should think again.
Saudi Arabia is one of the last remaining absolute monarchies in the world. With no parliament and very few written laws, 89-year-old King Abdullah gets to decide how the country will be run. Judges have the power to interpret the laws according to the country's strict Wahhabi interpretation of Islam and issue verdicts and punishments accordingly. In December, a sweeping anti-terrorism law was approved and appeared in print in its entirety for the first time last week in Al-Qura, the government's official gazette. This law will allow security services to raid homes, track cell phone calls and internet activity, with no prior approval required from judges or superiors. Suspects can be held incommunicado for up to 90 days, and lawyers are not required to be present for interrogations. Saudi women who defy the anti-driving rules can be arrested and punished. President Obama is scheduled to visit Saudi Arabia next month to discuss Middle East security and also the Saudi objections to U.S. policy in Syria and Iran. This stop in Saudi Arabia was added to Obama's previously announced trip to Europe. Obama's last trip to Saudi was in 2009. Human rights activists say that this new law allows the kingdom to prosecute anyone who demands reform, exposes corruption, or otherwise engages in dissent. Demands for democratic reform have grown since the 2011 Arab Spring that toppled longtime autocrats. Human rights activists claim this law is clearly designed to keep the Al-Saud family in control. Others call it catastrophic and draconian.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, February 3rd, 2014. The Israeli army evicts a protest village in the Jordan Valley and settlers kidnap Palestinian shepherds from northern West Bank village. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. In Bethlehem City, southern West Bank, thousands of people attended the funeral on Monday of two Palestinians whose remains were returned by Israel a day earlier. On Sunday, relatives gathered at Tarkumia checkpoint southwest of Hebron to receive the remains of Ayat al-Akhras from the Hesh refugee camp and Daoud al-Suwai from the village of Irtas. Al-Akhras, 18, died in 2002 after she detonated an explosive belt outside a supermarket in West Jerusalem, killing herself, 17-year-old Rachel Levy, and a security guard. Abu Suwai, 46, died after detonating an explosive belt in West Jerusalem outside the David Citadel Hotel. Three people were injured in the blast. They were both buried at Ash-Shuhada Cemetery in Artaz village near Bethlehem City. In other news, Israeli army forces have stormed and evicted the village of Al-Awda, or Return in English, that was established by Palestinian activists in the Jordan Valley area, which is threatened with confiscation. Activists told local news that the Israeli army started to raid the village on Sunday at midnight and evicted it by Monday morning. Israeli troops surrounded the village and prevented anyone, including journalists, from reaching the village. Six activists were arrested by troops and transferred to Jericho City, where they were then released. Also on Monday, Israeli settlers kidnapped two Palestinian men from the village of Jaba near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. According to local sources, the settlers kidnapped the two men as they were herding their sheep just outside the village. The settlers released the two civilians hours later after beating them up, local sources said. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, February 3rd, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
The LA Times reports that Pakistan's efforts to open peace talks with Islamic insurgents gathered steam Saturday when Taliban leaders nominated a five-member committee to represent them at the negotiating table. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, recently admitted that he has not spoken with U.S. President Barack Obama during the past 7 months. While speaking during an interview with The Telegraph, President Karzai said that he saw no good in the American presence in Afghanistan. The campaign for Afghanistan's presidential election has been formally launched with rallies for key candidates in the capital, Kabul. The election is scheduled to take place on April 5th. There are 11 candidates to replace Hamid Karzai, who cannot stand again. Afghanistan's ambassador to Australia says cutting aid to his country may result in more asylum seekers trying treacherous seas to reach Australian shores.
Anti-whaling activists in the Southern Ocean near Australia had their ship rammed by a Japanese whaling vessel on Sunday. The activists say the whalers deliberately attacked their ship and engaged in other actions to try to damage the Sea Shepherd vessel. The activists used the ship to blockade whaling operations and have them themselves engaged in ramming of other ships in the past. Here's a report from ITN News about Sunday's incident.
Hold back. Sea Shepherd Australia collides with a Japanese whaling boat in the Southern Ocean. The conservation group, which has long been challenging the legality of Japan's annual whale hunt, released the video, which appears to show one of its ships, the Bob Barker, being struck by the harpoon vessel as it crossed in front of its bow. According to the organisation, the ship was rammed as part of what they called an attack by three Japanese boats on two Sea Shepherd ships. The group say that more than 10,000 whales have been killed since the start of the International Moratorium on Commercial Whaling in 1986.
The Sea Shepherd Conservation Group says that, although their ship was damaged, they will continue their nonviolent actions to stop whaling operations in the Southern and Pacific Oceans. The Australian government announced Sunday that it will launch an investigation into the incident. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Rosalind Scott, and Emily Young. The producer is Joe Meyer. Our engineer is Danielle Parks, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hills can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Mike Klepfer.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, the hosts focus on how tar sand oil companies are digging up tens of thousands of acres of pristine forest in Canada and leaving behind a toxic wasteland. At 9 on Alternative Radio, Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Pacific University, speaks on the Olympics, Celebration Capitalism. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Dennis Bernstein hosts Flashpoints, investigative news radio. At 11, on Stage and Studio, host DeMay Roberts interviews Bill Foster, executive director of the Northwest Film Center on the 37th Portland International Film Festival. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan hosts a digital art panel with Stephen Slapp, Crystal South, and Theo Downs-Le Guin. They'll discuss net art, mobile apps, art that exists only in computers, glitch art, and the backlash against software and slick finishes. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. Our membership drive is coming right up. Please help us by becoming a member or renewing.
Stay tuned now for Jimmy Tardy, live from Pioneer Square, as part of the international protest against the Keystone XL pipeline.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO Evening News In Depth. We're going to go live downtown now to Jimmy Tardy, who's attending a protest, a rally against the Keystone XL pipeline. Hello, Jimmy, are you there?
Hello, yes, I'm here. I'm here at Terry Schrunk Plaza down here in front of the Edith Wyatt Federal Building. There's a crowd gathered. It's around 50 people already, and the rally doesn't even start for another 10 or 15 minutes. And I've got a handful of people here for you to talk with and hear from about why they're here opposing the Keystone XL pipeline. I'm going to hand you to Jim here.
Hello, Jim.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. Our crowd's building up here, and we are not at the start time yet, so we're expecting a big crowd.
Excellent. Can you describe why you're at this event tonight?
I've been working on this project for a while, and our intent is to tell the president that the citizens are concerned about climate change. The important thing is for the president to make a decision and stop the pipeline, and the reason for that is that the climate's heating up, and it's time to get the control of that decision away from the fossil fuel companies.
Can you describe for listeners what the Keystone XL pipeline is and what impact it'll have on climate change?
I'll let you ask that question to another person.
Okay.
Hey, we've got Julie here.
Hello,
here
Julie.
Hi there, how's it going?
I'm all right. Yourself? How are you?
Yeah.
Why are you at this rally tonight?
Well, I'm at this rally. I have a responsibility as an 18-year-old and a member of the current generation and the generation to come to make sure that there is decently clean air, clean water, healthy ecosystems, and really trying to make sure that Obama doesn't make an extraordinarily stupid mistake. I know he's a smart guy. I know he's tried standing up for the environment, but we really, really need to hold him accountable here because we can't have this huge tar sand snowball rolling and rolling and making our environment crappier and crappier. We have to stand up.
Can you describe what the Keystone XL pipeline is and what effect it'll have on the climate?
yeah, what effect it will have on the climate. Keystone XL pipeline is a giant pipeline running from Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico carrying tar sands oil, which is a very crude, inefficient form of fossil fuels. And its effect on the climate is basically every gallon of oil that will go through that pipeline will be burned as soon as possible because it is money going through that pipeline that corporations want. And if they sell it, they burn it. All of that oil burned will go into our atmosphere and just screw things up because it's carbon dioxide that's being released, which enhances the greenhouse effect warming our planet.
Well, thank you. That was very succinct. Are you affiliated with any organization, or are you just there on your own volition?
I'm affiliated with 350 PDX, as well as the NOKXL Pledge of Resistance.
What's the scene down there at Terry Shrunk like right now?
Yeah, right now I see a bunch of people. Everyone is really, really seems excited to go. There's candles. There's some people playing flutes, holding banners. I think you heard the estimate about 50 people. It's definitely growing at least 60 or 70 now, hopefully.
Is there a program for tonight? Are there going to be speakers?
Sorry, what was the second part of the question?
Are there going to be speakers at this event? What's the plan for tonight?
That's a very good question. I believe there will be a few speakers. I know Bonnie McKinley is one of the major, is a good leader here. But definitely just trying to get a bunch of different people together. I know we're all here for different reasons. Getting our signs, talking to each other, talking to passersby, talking to media, really trying to get the message out.
So who are some of the supporters of the Keystone XL pipeline?
Some of the supporters of the Keystone XL pipeline?
Yes.
As far as I know, most oil companies, because they know that if Keystone XL pipeline gets killed, then that knows Obama's cracking down on crappy fossil fuel companies everywhere. I should pass it on because I've been talking for a long time.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to pass it off to Rick now. Here you go, Rick. Good evening.
Hello, Rick. How you doing?
Pretty well, thanks. And you?
I'm all right. Can you describe why you're at this event tonight?
Yeah, it seems to me the science is so clear that most of the known fossil fuel reserves need to stay in the ground permanently. And I can't really think of any source of fossil fuels better than the ugly tar sands of Alberta to make the point that we're going to decide to start doing that, and no better opportunity than the president has at this point to say no to Keystone, to say that this is the turning point where we turn from his, frankly, insane policy of all of the above on energy sources and start turning off the tap on fossil fuels and their CO2 emissions that are going to ruin the climate.
You mentioned the president's all-of-the-above energy policy, meaning anything from what's generally termed as green coal or clean coal to natural gas, which is extracted via fracking. What makes you think that Barack Obama would change his mind on the Keystone XL and come down in favor of not building the pipeline?
Well, you know, one can hope against hope, I guess. Part of it is showing the public opposition here and elsewhere all across the country. He is a politician, and he's subject to that kind of pressure. You also have people like John Kerry, who has committed himself to, you know, for many years, doing the right thing on climate. I have no doubt that at some fundamental level, he gets it. He knows how wrong it would be to approve this pipeline. Whether they'll have the political foresight and the courage to make that recommendation to the president, I can't know. But to the greater extent that he understands that he's got the support of the public, like the folks gathered here and who they represent, can hope that, as I say, they'll recognize it's time for the turning point.
Can you describe past popular resistance to the Keystone XL pipeline?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Can you talk about other instances where people have come out to protest the Keystone XL and what those have looked like?
Oh, I mean, there's been a vast number of things all across the country. It's hard for me to summarize, you know, starting in Canada with the indigenous folks there, the southern leg of the pipeline, everything from
peaceful civil disobedience to people chaining themselves to equipment and pipelines, it's really significant and impressive. I don't know if others here, there are more people here who might want to expand on that, but it's been good talking with you. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Hey, so I've got Kath here to talk with you.
Kath.
Hi.
Hello.
I hear you're gathering some background on the KXL pipeline. I'm happy to provide that.
Sure.
The KXL pipeline, well, the XL stands for extra large. It is designed to really open the spigot on the tar sands oil, which is in northern Alberta, and it is the dirtiest heavy crude on the planet. This whole adventure up there is disrupting the lives of indigenous people, poisoning the water. They've torn down their arboreal forests where their wildlife that they depend on used to live. They're poisoning the water supplies up there. All to get this, and they're using tons of water, amazing amounts of water and energy, to pull these dirty pipe tar sands out of the ground, get the oil out of them, and get them in this big pipeline that wants to go through western Montana, North Dakota. The Oglala Sioux have said they will not allow this pipeline to go through any of their tribal lands nor their ceded lands. That means the lands that the government took away from them with treaties last century. And that these pipelines, the State Department came out with their environmental impact study last Friday afternoon to bury it in the back of people's minds during Super Bowl weekend, hoping that it would just fade out of sight. However, we've been gearing up for this, 350.org, oil change, rising tide, the environmental defense fund, just a lot of organizations, many more than I can mention, have been waiting for this decision to come out. And when the news came out that the bottom line was that this will not affect the climate, well, we hit the fan because of course it will. From the mining of it to the transportation of it, where it might spill in pristine aquifers all along its way, on its way down to Texas, including the Ogallala Aquifer, which is the biggest aquifer in the center part of our breadbasket.
Kath, I'm sorry, I have to stop you there. We've reached the end of our time here, but for anyone that wants to head to this event tonight, it is taking place right now at the Park Blocks, Terry Shrunk Plaza, in front of the Federal Building in Portland. I thank Jimmy Tardy for getting this event for radio, and we're going to leave it there. This has been the KBOO Evening News.
You saw an army of South African youth with grenades, with Makarovs, with AK-47s, and I think that that's reflected a lot in the songs, because the songs had to articulate a new urgency and a new direction.
This Thursday, February 6th, from 4 to 6 p.m., KBOO presents a two-hour membership drive special, Amandla, honoring the legacy of Nelson Mandela and other fighters who struggled for decades to free South Africa from the racist system of government known as apartheid. We'll feature excerpts from the film Amandla, which means power in Zulu, and a live interview with Portland's own Mike Crenshaw, who recently spent time in South Africa collaborating with hip-hop artists there. That's this Thursday from 4 to 6 p.m., 90.7 FM.
KBOO is proud to present the 2014 Grateful Dead and Friends Marathon,
Saturday, February 8th from 12 noon to 12 midnight. This year's show will feature The Grateful Dead, The Friends, and Come Right Back Around Again. That's the KBOO Grateful Dead and Friends Marathon, broadcasting live on FM at 90.7 and streaming over the World Wide Web at kboo.fm on Saturday, February 8th, 12 noon to 12 midnight. Log on, tune in, and rock out.
Years ago, four lads from Liverpool invaded America.
You say you will love me if I have to go. You'll be thinking of me. Somehow I will know.
Join KBOO February 7th from noon to 4 as we pay tribute to John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
To celebrate Valentine's Day and Oregon's birthday, KBOO Community Radio will host a special day of news and public affairs programming. For Love of a Better World will be a 12-hour special focusing on the transformational place we find ourselves, solutions to get out of the muck, and the groups and individuals who are fighting the good fight. For Love of a Better World, KBOO's news and public affairs 12-hour special, February 14th, from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
I'm having a tough time right now. They're getting their lunch fat to them every day.
The time is 6:04, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Up next is Labor Radio, a special hour-long Labor Radio, and Prison Pipeline will be with us next week at the normal time at 6:30. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide can be found online at redirectguide.com.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.